part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm gonna do it part. I'm gonna do it part-time. I'm gonna do it part. Fanboy.com.
This is the Cannibal Horror Cast. I am Mark underscore L underscore Miller, aka Ambush Bug, aka
God of
filling in for filling in for JD this week as host of the Cannibal Horror Cast because JD's out for a little while. But we were lucky enough to have a couple of our regulars and someone new coming in to join us. So let's start with who we already know. Christian Dabari, how you doing today?
Hey, how's it going?
Good, good. And we've got Bottle Imp here.
What's up, honkies?
Yep. And our new person here this week is Christian Horn. Christian, can you tell the listeners about like what you do?
I will tell them what I told them on this week's comic podcast, which is
yes.
That I used to be superhero on the reviewing comic review section of Ain't It Cool, and now I have my own little podcast called Part-Time Fanboy, and you can check that out on parttimefanboy.com. And I also helped to develop a friend's comic property, which is called Baby Badass, and that is on babybadass.com, and you should check it out because if you're a horror fan, there's lots of gore and guts in it too. Well, not lots, but there's enough in it to keep you interested if you're into horror.
I just got my copy. I'm gonna read it tonight.
Yeah, you said that last night.
Well, I didn't get to it last night, but tonight I will. So we're going to be talking about two movies tonight. We're going to start out with A Nightmare on Elm Street. It's a little movie. Not too many people have seen this one. It's something
kind of an art house flick.
Yes, it's like art housey. I don't know, but we're gonna introduce you all to this movie because we can. It was from 2010, directed by Samuel Bayer.
Wait a minute, I watched the wrong one.
It stars Jackie Earle Haley. No, I'm just kidding.
Thank God.
I'm repeating a joke. I'm repeating a joke that JD did last time on another similar thing where we reviewed Creep. But I don't think we have any correspondence from the last thing. Or if we did, JD didn't share that. So we'll just go right into the reviews. So, Nightmare on Elm Street, it came out in 1984. And it was written and directed by Wes Craven.
Yes.
And stars Heather Langenkamp, Johnny Depp, Robert Englund, John Saxton, Amanda Wiss. And who else?
Introducing Johnny Depp, I will have you know.
Yes. Lin Shea is in this, as is Charles Fleischer. He makes a little appearance as a doctor. There's a lot of little...
Roger Rabbit, the voice of Roger Rabbit.
Yeah, Roger Rabbit. Lin Shea, who's in the Insidious movies, is in there just as a teacher in the school. And so it's funny, you see these little kind of cameos of people that kind of show up later on in horror. But I don't know. Let's go around the horn and see about...
You can go around me. That's fine.
Yes. Go around the Christian horn and see what were your initial thoughts? When did you first see this movie?
Who wants to start?
How about Bodlin?
I came to this a little bit later. I probably didn't see it until maybe middle school, early high school. Out of the kind of the trifecta of class horror movies, I'd seen Halloween the earliest, and then Friday the 13th, and then Nightmare on Elm Street. It's one of those movies where I think it's got a lot of really cool moments. There's definitely some stuff that's really just innovative and interesting. As a whole, watching it again for the podcast, there's some stuff there that's a little cheesy, and in the ending, I still think is just kind of one of those wackadoo endings that doesn't really make any sense, but there's definitely a lot of cool stuff in there. And I don't know if it, you know, if the, how many sequels did they make? Like six sequels?
Oh God, how many
more?
I think they made more than six. I think there are maybe nine.
If we count like the Freddy versus Jason and stuff, I mean, it's kind of impressive they were able to mine it and keep going back to the well so often.
The well gets shallower and shallower. I go back to that well.
They keep having to dig new wells, and all of a sudden, like Freddy Krueger is like the spawn of Satan and a nun or whatever it was. There's stuff in this movie that I love and I don't think it's been equaled in other horror movies. Just little visual things, it was never one of my favorite horror movies. You know, I know it's a lot of people's favorites, but I always prefer the Halloween franchise.
Okay. Christian Dabari, how about you?
I think I had first seen it probably 86.
Oh, wow.
I think it was on HBO or something. Back then, I know I've said this more than once already, but back then, when I was a kid, I used to plot my viewings late night while, you know, my parents went to sleep. So I'd sneak into the living room, you know, quiet, stealth-like. I'd have the volume at a perfect, you know, level so I could hear it, that it wasn't too loud. And, that was the first time I saw it. But, you know, honestly, back then, it's still kind of today, I'm more of a Friday the 13th fan, but it was effective for the time. I really did like the first one a lot, and the rest of them, as far as I remember, were more comedic and campy and silly than anything else. But this movie, for what it is, I still think it's pretty fairly strong. I think I do agree the ending is so weird. And funny enough, I saw a documentary, this crazy long documentary about the Nightmare
series.
I can't remember what it's called. But
Never Sleep Again.
Never Sleep Again. I know the guy who produced it or co-produced it. Yeah, I used to work with that guy. Yeah.
That's an excellent documentary,
it is,
by the way.
Yeah.
It's really good. But, like, I didn't even know until I saw that documentary that the ending was three endings they just edited together.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It does. Like, you actually go watch it. Just watch the ending. From the point where the whole bed scene, you know, when the mother is getting sucked into the bed, and then from that point on, that's like ending number one, then ending number two, and then ending number three with like the mother getting sucked into the door or whatever.
This is the last Lord of the Rings of horror movies. It just has these false ending.
I just looked it up
and it has had nine things, including Freddy versus Jason, nine movies.
Wow, that's amazing. Does that include
it doesn't count the TV series or comic books or anything like that,
or the reboot,
or the remake, right?
Yeah, including the reboot.
That's impressive.
Yeah, I mean, but you know, like Halloween has got, I think, just as much, if not more. And still, Friday the 13th is the king with 12. Actually, there was just announced that there was going to be a new remake of Nightmare on Elm Street. So
remake?
They haven't released any other information about it, but. Who knows? I doubt. I interviewed Robert Englund a couple of months ago, and he said that he has totally retired. He's never going to do that again.
He said
the makeup has done enough damage to his face, and he doesn't want to go back and do that sort of thing again. He's too old for this shit. Danny Glovering it.
Yeah.
But I'm sure if there's a paycheck, who knows? You know,
would he give his blessing to somebody else, like donning Freddy, or should end it with me? I mean, they already tried it with Jackie Earle.
I mean, he sounded gracious, and I was looking up the trivia for this movie, and one of the funny things is that when Robert Englund went to interview for the role of Freddy, or no, it was Jackie Earle Haley went with Johnny Depp to audition for the role of Glenn, and Jackie Earle Haley was with him, which is weird because like years later now Jackie Earle Haley turned out to be playing Freddy in the sequel or
that's
the
crazy.
Remake,
wow.
Which is kind of a weird like little 6 degrees of Nightmare on Elm Street. But anyway, Christian, how about you? What was your first experience with this?
I can remember, honestly, I think this is the very first time I've seen it all the way through from like beginning to end, which is really weird because I was watching it last night on Netflix and I was just like, I don't think I've ever seen the opening of this movie, like the showing of the knives and like Freddy working in the basement, and you know, it's kind of like framed with the black around it and the credits kind of roll, and you know, I don't know that I've ever seen it like all the way through. This was a movie that was probably on like at parties, like in high school, like people would have the VHS like in the background and you would stop and watch it, or sometimes it would be on cable and I would catch it, and I know that I've seen most of it, but I don't know that I've ever sat through and watched the whole thing.
So this is the first time you've ever seen it all.
Yeah, I think this is the very first time. Like I've from beginning to end, I've seen the whole thing. You know how it is. Like
yeah,
stuff
yeah.
is on
no,
TV.
But that's an interesting perspective to have on this, because I do think that it's an interesting. I mean, it's a movie that makes an impact, I think, the first time.
Yeah, first time I mean, this is not. I mean, I've seen a lot of it. Let's just put it that way. But you know, like watching it this time, it gets a lot of mileage on the concept alone. I think that the whole thing of like somebody invading your dreams and the things that happen in your dreams being able to kill you in real life, that goes a long way. And I was very surprised by a lot of things, like how bad some of the acting was. I was just like, wow. in particular, Heather Langenkamp, who starts off in the movie like really, her acting is like really bad. But I really am curious to see, how did they shoot this? Did they shoot this like in sequence or out of sequence? Because her acting gets much better as the movie goes on. You know what I mean? And then the other thing that surprised me about this movie was how little of Freddy's personality was really developed. You know, there wasn't a lot of the wisecracking. There wasn't a lot of like the puns. There wasn't a lot of the stuff that you kind of became used to, like in the sequels, you know, or the icon that he became. Like he was much more of a, he was much creepier in this movie, like very, yeah. a little bit more straightforward. Yeah. Yeah.
It wasn't, it was not until like the third and the fourth that he really started getting kind of with Freddy, and it really became almost like a lot of puns, that kind of a little bit in the first movie, but it was all sinister.
Yeah.
He's definitely much more of like a kind of like just, he's much more of a nightmare in this one. I think that he's in the shadows much more. He's not really, he doesn't really have many one-liners. He says some things like, I mean, he jokes around I guess the biggest joke he has is when he puts his let's suck face. It's when he kisses on the phone. I'm your boyfriend now. And it's like that's even something much more diabolical than it is like a bad pun. Because it used, like, it got to the point where it's like he was like just really, he was like the Arnold Schwarzenegger of horror movies there for a while. Chill out.
Cool it. The one I remember the most, I think the fourth one, is when he takes the TV and he's like, get ready for prime time, bitch.
Oh, yeah.
Smashes the girl's head.
You know, the third one I think still has, it's still kind of diabolical Freddy. But I think after the third one is when it just got really cartoony and campy and just really kind of went off the rails as to like, this guy is no longer, you're not supposed to be afraid of him. It's just more like you're kind of you're laughing with him. You're just like there with him, like slaughtering all these kids. I mean, in this one, at least it gives you some characters to like. And I mean, I kind of agree that the acting is kind of rough, but I'm kind of used to that in horror movies.
Especially horror movies of this period.
Yeah. I mean, and I think Amanda Wiss, who plays Tina,
she's great.
She's really good in this. And Rod Lane, her boyfriend, is really good. Johnny Depp is really not that good in this movie.
very stiff in this movie.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just to go back to me, I remember when I first saw this movie, I rented this right when it came out on video, and I don't know what year it was, but I remember my brother and I were watching it in the living room, and my mom was having like a class reunion meeting, and there was a bunch of old ladies in the other room, and they were all like laughing and talking and everything, and we were watching this movie, and we turned out the lights, and we were like, and we were scared shitless of this. We were really young when we saw this, but it was like, I just remember just thinking how cool this was as a kid and just loving it and just really just liking, like loving the, like how awesome it was that he was, you got to see him build this glove at the beginning, and then you got to see like some of these nightmares, and the nightmares are really scary. I think that, yeah, like, I mean, especially that classroom scene where Nancy falls asleep in class, yeah, and she follows Tina out into the hallway. That's, I mean, that's really, really scary stuff. And I don't think any of the any of the sequels ever really get to that level of scary.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. I thought that there were a lot of really good, you know, quote unquote, like kills, you know what I mean? And I think that scene where Amanda Wiss gets like thrown up into the ceiling and is like just being dragged along and she's screaming her head off and her boyfriend's like, oh, what's going on? You know, like that to me, that's the part where I sat up and I was like, oh, like I get it. Like I remember now, you know what I mean? Because for the first part of this movie, I was like, yeah, this is all really cool. Like, but it has yet to impress me as an adult. And then when that sort of set piece like occurred, I was like, oh, I'm all in. Like, I was like, this is it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of the moments that I think is really strong. And this is one of the things I like about this movie is it shows what you could do when you're, you know, a young filmmaker with a low budget and just lots of innovation, mm-hmm, and doing like the spinning room trick to do that and having her up on the ceiling and everything. And it's just, you watch that and it's so well done because of the sense of the weight of it. Whereas like today they do it with computers, obviously, but you miss out on that sense of just the wrongness, you know? It would probably end up looking like somebody who's just floating on the ceiling and be like, oh, that's kind of fakey. You've seen that a bunch of times before, no big deal.
Yeah, but it'd be done in CGI or something, yeah, and it's just not as good.
Well, the reason it works so well, sorry, just let me interject, is because she's being dragged, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's like, ooh, this is kind of rough. Like somebody, like it's pretty intense, and I got sucked into it. Like I was like, wow, this is really harsh, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, she was, and she's screaming at like bloody murder.
Yeah, yeah,
all the way through, like at the top of her lungs, and it's just, yeah, it's really good. And it's like, you know, Wes Craven probably just snuck onto the Lionel Richie dancing on the ceiling video set, and just really, just, you know, just took a day or two to film it up and cover it with blood, and then Lionel Richie comes back in, and he was like, hey, what's going on? There's blood all over my.
Hello, is it me you're looking for? No, I thought that sequence was really well done. I couldn't tell that the room was being moved around. Obviously, she was, you know, on a floor being hooked into a... I can't remember. I do remember in the documentary, they explain a little bit about how it was done and that she... I think she was kind of bruised up from what I remember from that sequence. But that whole thing was like totally awesome. And from then on in, I was definitely sucked into the movie, you know?
Yeah. I mean, so it sounds like everybody, and I'm of the same boat. I mean, it sounds like no one here is like a diehard Nightmare on Elm Street fan. Is that true?
No, I'm not. I wouldn't say I am. I always was kind of like wishy-washy with it. Like I felt like it got too jokey, it got too corny, and that the Freddy's Dead one, when I went to see that with a bunch of friends, I thought that was just a big piece of shit.
Yeah.
I thought it fucking sucked. I was like, seriously, this is it? Like,
yeah,
you get this such a big deal, and like the movie itself was just a massive turd. It was terrible. So
you know, in Freddy's Dead, there are snippets of kind of cool little parts, like when you flash back to young Freddy, like smashing the heads of
Get out of here. Really? No, I don't think I've ever seen that.
No, they flash back on little baby Freddy and he's like back behind the barn. He's like smashing the heads in of mice or birds or something.
Freddy's dead?
Yeah, and Freddy's dead.
I don't remember. I only saw it that one time. But I hated it.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it had Roseanne Barr in it. It was terrible. Yeah. And Tom Arnold.
Oh, really?
In it.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just at that point they always had to have like a stupid like star cameo in there.
Oh, the thing that's interesting about these movies is that, you know, and like you guys, I was never like a Nightmare on Elm Street like huge fan. That they sort of kind of, I guess all the movies that have like 12 sequels or whatever, they sort of start to like blend into one another. I think more in particular these, because of Freddy and like his quips and, you know, the crazy death scenes that they come up with. They almost start to become like one giant blob of like a movie where it's like you kind of, unless you're like really into them or you've seen them a lot, they kind of don't, there's nothing about each individual movie that kind of sticks out in and of itself, except for maybe Dream Warriors. I think that that's the one that everyone really likes, right? That's, they say that that's the best one, correct? Patricia Arquette.
I definitely think that like I'm an appreciator of the series. I can find good things out of all of them, I think. Same thing with Friday the 13th. I can find a good thing about like pretty much every one of them, even though I know that a lot of them are shitty.
Extremely but yeah, forgiving
I do think
soul.
That I do think that like as it goes on, there's this kind of it's just the you know, you go to the well so many times and then you just have less and less water and less to pull from. They kind of I don't know what they're going to be doing with this new version of it. It sounds like they're not really paying attention to the old remake, so who knows what'll happen, but yeah, it'll be weird.
Wow, it's almost like a Fantastic Four of horror movies. They kind of.
How many years has it been since the last reboot? Only like 4 years, 5 years?
Yeah, that was 2010. So
really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so like 5 years ago. So I guess it's time to get back out there. Do some dreaming again. But, I mean, what did you guys think of Robert Englund in this one? I think he was really good.
Yeah.
I mean, this really showed that I think that he made it. I definitely think that he made this role his.
Oh, yeah.
And really, I just really thought of his performance was just pretty amazing. As
Freddie is actually a character unlike, you know, Halloween, Friday the 13th, and it's usually, you know, it's a guy in a mask, and you know, nothing, no disrespect to people who play Jason or Michael Myers, but you could pretty much put anybody back there, but Freddy actually had a personality, had a character, and that was all Englund. And I actually found it really interesting on the documentary that when they started filming Nightmare on Elm Street, they just had a stuntman in the makeup, and it was just a big dude lumbering around, and they had I forget pointed it out, if it was a producer or what, you gotta get Robert, you can't just have anybody be ready, it's not, and you know, he really did a lot character.
I wanted to kind of bring up just like basically just Wes Craven's like idea for this and everything. And I recently, I don't know if you guys had a chance to see The Nightmare, that documentary that we talked about this on the podcast a while back. But it was basically about Night Terrors and Shadow People. And
no.
That the concept of basically, it's a documentary made by the guy that did Room 237, which was the big Stanley Kubrick Shining conspiracy documentary.
Oh, yeah, okay.
This movie really deals with the whole concept of nightmares and how, like, the shadow people hauntings and things like that. And oftentimes, like, when you're in a dream, you're lucid in there, or you're awake and you can't move and you're stuck in your dream. And they were talking about imagery that they would see of people, and one of which is a man in a hat, a man in a fedora. And they were all talking about this. And these were people like hundreds of miles away from each other, all talking about the same sort
of phenomenon.
And also they talked about the kind of like contagion of this sort of thing, where they would tell somebody about it, and then all of a sudden they would have the same dream, or they would have the same experience at some point in the night. And I, as a kid, and I occasionally I still do have kind of like waking nightmares, or I've woken up really petrified and really had that kind of like feeling that somebody was in the room with me, or somebody, or there was a shadow moving across the thing that I or something like that.
And he's right behind you.
Yes, but I've felt that before, and so I just didn't know. Have you guys felt that way? Did you guys feel that connection with the nightmare stuff in this movie, or is that just me being an idiot?
No, I've never had any kind of like night terrors or anything like that. So.
I've had nightmares, you know, right. And stuff that freaks me out and that sticks with you. And but I've never had like anything like feeling like there's a presence in the room. Apparently, when I was younger, I would maybe like sleepwalk every once in a while and not remember it. And mm-hmm. my mother would be like, you came in my room and you stood right next to the bed and you were talking about something. And I was like, what are you talking about, crazy woman? I never did anything like that. But no, what about the other Christian?
Yeah, actually, funny enough, same as you, nightmares mostly. And when I was younger, I was sleepwalking in the hallway, and I was mumbling about my arm was cut off.
Whoa!
Shit.
Yeah. Apparently, my sister woke me up, and I just was like, what the fuck is going on? Like, I couldn't believe I was standing up in the hallway. And it was weird, because I was, like, thinking for a moment. I was so disoriented that, is this another dream? Change to this one? Like, what the hell? It was a real weird moment, but that's it.
Yeah, I can just imagine that Wes Craven probably experienced some of this stuff. I mean, just to be able to write, to tap into this stuff, because there is that, they really do tap into this whole, like, dream, what is reality? The ending is, like, sort of like a dream within a dream, sort of. You don't know if they're stuck in a dream or what, and that's just, to me, that was, I understand the hokiness of the ending, but what they were trying to get at was kind of I think it was kind of really prolific what they were trying
don't
to go
you
into.
Think that the end is a little bit like trying too hard to be like a really good episode of the Twilight Zone, you know what I mean? Like where some episodes of the Twilight Zone, the ending was so profound and like freaky that you would just be like, whoa. Like when, even as an adult, some of those old Twilight Zones that maybe I'll forget about, haven't seen in years, and I'll see them again and I'll be like, man, that is a heavy ending. I think they might have been trying a little too hard for something like that, for the audience to go like, they're in a dream or something like that.
It felt to me like almost like it was, I don't know, like it was trying to be a Carrie, or it was trying to be the ending of a Friday the 13th rather than a Twilight Zone. Because like a Twilight Zone, it's kind of like a big twist at the end. And it's like just like an oh shit moment where all of a sudden everything you thought was going on is turned ass upwards.
That's where I feel like they might have failed a bit, where they didn't get the oh shit moment or the ass upwards moment, and I think they were trying for that. And for me, I was like, oh, okay, you know what I mean? Like it didn't play out like as strongly. Maybe if I was younger and seen it for the first time, I'd be like, oh my god, get out of the car, the roof is the color of Freddy's sweater. You know what I mean? But yeah, I get you.
What'd you guys think of the ending? Steven, what'd you think of the ending?
Well, first off, the ending in the house where she just like turns her back on Freddy and is like, I don't believe in you or whatever.
Yeah.
And he just kind of vanishes into like cheesy, like transporter beam effect. that one is just like, also leading up to that, I say that all the power of the beginning of the movie with all the ending, she rigs a booby trap. Like there's a part of me that I was really fast, and I was thinking, did John Hughes see this movie and said, you know, I'm going to redo that, but I'm going to do it with a kid and then bump and tease Freddy. It was like Home Alone. She had like all these booby traps, like was giving them like the fun crap.
I don't know. I kind of like that. It just shows the resourcefulness of like Nancy.
Does it? Macaulay Culkin actually use... didn't Macaulay Culkin actually use that gag with the sledgehammer in one of the Home Alone movies?
He might as well have.
Yeah.
But it was just, I don't know, it really, to me, took away a lot of the power when all of a sudden he was getting the shit out of him by booby traps. but I do, as wacky as like the multiple dream endings are, I do like the weird moody. It's got that like fog. Like the sun, there's all this fog around. Everybody who's died is there. They go far, and then, you know, her mom, who's, you know, creepy hell anyways, gets like sucked through the window. In a way that, you know, you don't want to explain it too much. I do think it's kind of funny that with every sequel after, you know, when they brought back Heather Langenkamp to play Nancy again, the next installments, they pretty much ignored the ending of the movie because there's no way that you can have a sequel after that ending. So they're just like, okay, forget all that shit. Like, that never happened. She just beat Freddy and that's it.
Yeah. They did kind of just like ignore that. I do think that there were some... It definitely feels like they ran out of money towards the end of the film because the effects get worse and worse as it goes on. Like there's the mom that rises out of the bed and just it's just a skeleton, kind of like, and that's kind of weird. And then just
like the haunted house kind of thing.
The mannequin that they pull through the little door window is just
Naked Gun. It's like Naked Gun. That was something straight out of Naked Gun.
Yeah, the legs were like completely straight.
I thought it was a blow up doll. Yeah,
it looked like a
blow up doll. It must have been something inflatable because they didn't even squeeze it through, right?
But it was
that's why I sped up the film so much so you can tell that it was like blow up Wanda dragged through there.
Yeah, and even the dialogue, she was like, you know, I don't think I'm gonna drink anymore.
Well, that's, I gotta say, that makes me think, you know, they were thinking about like a dream ending for Nancy, because like obviously she, you know, knew her mother was drinking, and maybe it was like her happy dream where like her mom would stop drinking and, you know, get her shit together. So, you know, and if you look at it that way, then like that line kind of makes sense. But it's weird. It's definitely a jumble. Like you said, I think they were trying to go for that shock ending.
Mom was hitting the sauce in this movie.
Oh yeah.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah. Big time. What was she drinking? Was that vodka?
I don't know.
Alcohol?
I think she was drinking a little bit of everything. She was
hitting the sauce big time. Yeah.
She also looked a lot like John Lithgow. Like John Lithgow in The World According to Garp when he's playing Roberta Muldoon.
Yeah.
You're not John Lithgow in Raising Cain when he dresses like a woman.
The mom's acting was, I'm sorry, and this woman has been nominated for an Oscar. The mom's acting was really not great for me. And I was like, wow, can we take back your Oscar nomination for this? Like, apparently she was in Nashville and she must have done a great job. I have not seen Nashville. I'm going to have to see it now. So many people have told me to see it throughout the years, and now I'm going to have to see it because I want this woman to redeem herself, because I thought she was one of the weakest links in the movie.
Well, she's drunk the whole time. I think she's a decent drunk.
I don't think she looks like that lady who's there
a little bit too late when the kids finally come into the bar, and it's like she's looking around for some hot young tail.
Oh, no. I don't know. And
she's
then,
a little sloppy.
Yeah. She drove me nutty during the movie.
Well, I mean, for the sake of time, I mean, I think that Nightmare on Elm Street, we could probably talk about that for like hours, and just about like what happens, and we'll probably talk more about it.
One last thing. You got to mention how the biggest, I think, innovation of this movie was the fact that the female protagonist like turns the tables, right? Because I don't think you'd ever really seen like a female protagonist just be like, "I'm not taking this crap anymore. I'm gonna fight him," and then she kind of like. kind of turns the tables on him a bit. Like, I thought that was really cool.
I agree. I mean, I think it was just really an extension of the final girl that you usually see in, like, Friday the 13th, where it's like some of the Friday the 13th, you see them kind of turning back and fighting back against them. But really, it's more of like, it's not really an equal. They're not on even grounds. It's like Jamie Lee Curtis was still scared shitless, and she was never like fighting back and angry and not going to take it anymore. So I think that, yeah, I agree. Yeah, Nancy is kind of like a stronger kind of like female protagonist than like Jamie Lee Curtis or Adrienne King, who was in who was from the first Friday the 13th and things like that. She's more like Tina from Friday the 13th, the one where the new blood, you know, the one with Carrie powers.
Well,
you know?
This is the only horror movie from that era that I think where she literally says, like, I'm going to kick his ass. You know what I mean? She turns around and she says, like, I'm going to fight him. Like, you know, in other movies, you're right. They're being chased. And at some point they kind of like want to turn the tables, but it's sort of out of desperation. And this one, she kind of, you know, she goes a little MacGyver and she kind of turns the tables around on him a little bit. And I thought that was really cool. That was an element I really liked.
And that's kind of something that you see a lot in Wes Craven's early movies. I mean, if you watch Last House on the Left and Hills Have Eyes, they do the same sort of thing in those two movies. And I think that that's just Wes Craven kind of repeating himself a little bit. But it's definitely more effective in this movie than it is. I mean, it stands out more in this movie.
Way better than Last House on the Left.
Yeah.
That was a little bit much. It was like, Jesus Christ. Like, girls, like both of them, like
that movie.
I want to see Nancy go nuts and just cut off Freddy's penis.
How do we know it wasn't burned off?
Yeah, well, that's I don't know. Maybe that's what we'll see in the new remake. That's why there are so many unanswered questions, and they're going to do the remake.
On to the next movie.
On to the next movie. So It Follows. And as I was watching It Follows, I really noticed how similar in structure it is to Nightmare on Elm Street and Halloween. And I was wondering if you guys caught on to that. But It Follows was directed by David Robert Mitchell. And it was written by David Robert Mitchell. And it stars Micah Monroe from The Guest, who I thought she was just awesome in The Guest. And she was awesome here. And it's also got Keir Gilchrist as he's the Paul, the kind of nerdy guy that follows her around. And Daniel Zavato, who plays a young Johnny Depp in this movie. And then there's also Olivia Lucardi, who's the cute girl with the weird technological seashell. Palm Pilot thing. And there's the other one. Oh, Lily Seep, who plays her best friend, Kelly. So you guys, I think a lot of you guys just saw this movie, or did you guys see this a while ago?
I saw it when it came on video.
What are your initial thoughts? What do you guys think? Christian, what do you think?
I will say this. There was a lot of hype. A lot of hype. Already on the fence. I was like, last time this sort of thing happened, which was, I think, the Babadook for me, I just walked away like, I didn't care for it. But this one I liked, and this is going to make you laugh, but I think I liked it mostly because of the music. And I obviously for the lead, she's really good. I think she has a lot of potential. I hope in more and more stuff, obviously. The most effective thing for me, though, out of the whole film, was the very first scene where she's strapped to the wheelchair. That entire scene, I felt, was like so fun that everything else came after it just wasn't as good. It was like there was cool little bits, but I felt like that was the strongest moment where there was this nightmarish, fucked up shit going on, naked woman walking, kind of slow, you know, towards him and all that kind of stuff. Plus the camera angle that was like, you know, attached to her on the
wheelchair.
It was fantastic because it really just kind of, you know, it raises attention. But then after that, it just kind of, there was some parts of it that just was like an after school special,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
A little bit racier version of that. And I was just kind of like, all right, yeah, this is okay.
After but school I, special I, for like, the, you know, like abstinence, teenage abstinence or something like that.
Yes. I mean, and also, I get it, you know, she probably didn't do any super crunchy sex scenes and stuff like that. But I also was scratching my head, though, about how to really go too far with it. Like, it, you know what I'm saying? Like, it was like very tame. So,
yeah,
either it's about basic to STD. It's like the sex scenes were like undercovers and stuff. Like, is it? I mean, like, it's just, it was just very distracting, watered down. So it for me, it took away from the pleasure of sex, and then that.
Yeah. You know what I
mean? So that was weird.
Yeah, but I kind of agree with you just on that sense, because I'm thinking of like a David Cronenberg movie where they had some really uncomfortable sex scenes. Right. And it's like it highlights both the beauty and also the grotesque nature of sex. And like if this movie really had the teeth that it should, that it, that like everybody is like screaming that it does, it would go there. But I think that because it wants to be, I think it wants it both ways. It wants to be an edgy, like, film about sex, but it also wants to be a mainstream success. And so in order for it to do that, I don't think they could show that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, I'm not saying it needed to be, like, Basic Instinct or anything like that. You know, it didn't need to be, like, you know, super gratuitous, but
you wanted porn. Wanted porn.
Yeah, a little bit of porn. No, I'm kidding. It's like it was just very distracting. That every sex scene was like fully clothed and under the blankets, and I'm like, okay, this is weird. You know?
Well, I think also it's like these are actual kids, and like unlike Nightmare on Elm Street, where these guys are a little older, it's like I think Heather Langenkamp was like either 19 or 20 when she filmed the movie, and like Johnny Depp was in his 20s, and you could almost tell that it's like 21 Jump Street like phenomenon. Like here, these kids look like kids, and I think that they actually were. So it's like I think nudity was out of the question for that reason, for one thing, but also just because it just felt like it didn't go there because of that. It wanted that sort of like PG-13 sort of scenes.
You should tell this to Larry Clark.
Larry Clark, yeah, exactly.
That guy grosses me out. Like,
oh,
that,
yeah.
Like, honestly, like, I agree completely, but I think that maybe if they used, you know, doubles or something, or just to even apply nudity in the slightest bit, to just kind of, you know, sort of drive that point home just a little bit, like in terms of the sex being a little more convincing, you know, because the Larry Clark films are disgusting, man.
Like, yeah. No, I.
Oh, God. What?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do think that the opening scene where she's running away from the character, from the invisible thing, and we don't know what the hell is going on. She's just running in a circle, and then she's going out and sitting on the beach, and then she wakes up, and she's, like, on the beach, and her leg's, like, broken over her head, and it's like, all weird. It's weird that we never see anything else. That was the only horrific kind of like death that we really see. Like even the scenes like with the Johnny Depp lookalike there across the street. He,
I think you're giving that guy a little too much credit.
I don't know.
Yeah. Visual appearance.
Well, look, I just see so many similarities between this, because it's like in that scene specifically, she's in her room. She looks over, she sees the thing walk up. She's calling out to him. She's calling his phone and he's not answering.
Yeah.
And she goes there, it comes into the house, breaks into the house and kills him in his own room, just like Johnny Depp in Nightmare on Elm Street. I mean, that scene is almost like, it's almost like verbatim. Like if you were telling that scene it from both of those movies to the same person, you would think it was from the same movie.
Yeah, but Depp doesn't. Yeah. The new guy doesn't get sucked into his bed and blown out like a bloody Yosemite.
He just fucks his mom. I don't know which is worse.
Oh man. Yeah. Well, no. Was that his mom? I didn't think that it was his mom.
No, that it. She it took was, the form was, of his mom.
Yeah.
No. See, I didn't think that's what it was. See. Okay. Now we're gonna get into the weeds because I don't think that the creature. I thought that the creature. As the movie went on, I thought that the creature would take the shape of anybody who had contracted the STD. You see what I'm saying? So it wasn't
it could take anything.
They said that it could be anybody because earlier it was the weird chick with the glasses and the seashell.
Well, yeah.
She didn't contact STD.
That's true. I thought they were going to reveal something like when the nerd girl was the creature. But yeah, you guys are right. That kind of sucks because it ruins my big theory about the whole movie, which I thought would have been really clever, which was basically that the creature was taking on, you know, the shape of anybody that had contracted it in the past. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, because I agree.
I didn't think he slept with his mom though, because he opened the door and he thought it was his mom banging on the door, and then he opens the door and there's this woman with her breast, and who, as a teenage boy, is not going to be like, "This is awesome,"
unless it's your mom.
Yeah, exactly. Which I don't think it was his mom, but anyway,
no, it was.
Yeah, it was. It was the same actress. Yeah, it was the same actress.
Oh, I don't remember seeing his mom. As a matter of fact, that's one of the things that drove me crazy about the movie is that all this stuff kept happening, and you had like the Charlie Brown parents like not showing up. Like you didn't even get a voice like off the side going wah 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 wah. Like I was literally like, where is the mother? They talk about the mother, they talk about parents, they talk about an adult never shows up, and I'm like, come on, that's stretching it a little too much. I get what you're trying to do, but if you're gonna talk about the parents, have the parents show up at least in one scene at the hospital, something, you know. So that bugged me.
That ties into one of the reasons that I didn't like this movie. Oh. So, like Christian Debar, you mentioned the hype, and yes, this movie was so hyped up.
Yeah.
And so I was, unlike you, I really liked Babadook after all the hype. I enjoyed that one.
Me too.
So I came into this one, you know, kind of skeptical because of the hype, but I had high hopes. And I watched it, and I was kind of ambivalent and didn't really care for it after. But then JD posted a link on Facebook to a critical analysis of the film that made me hate this fucking movie. And I realized the reason that I now hate this movie is the reason I hate a lot of genre movies that critics cream their jeans over, is that critics love movies that try to be deep.
Yeah.
The same thing with, you know, Nolan's Dark Knight Rises or whatever it is, the third Batman movie, which I couldn't stand.
Me too.
And they were, you know, all over that one because of all its like heavy-handed symbolism for like the class warfare and stuff. This article was talking all about all these decisions they made to not show the parents because it's all about the children and it's their world, and you know, it shows the microcosm and the fact that everything is filmed in Detroit where everything's in decay. It's a symbolism of the, you know, sexual STD decay that can happen and the inevitability of death and the fact that that girl is reading from her little seashell Kindle, like books that have heavy-handed quotes about death and the inevitability of it.
Yeah.
And it was just so fucking pretentious.
Oh, yeah.
And all that kind of shit just like snowballed. And I'm like, here's the thing too, is like we talked in past podcasts about horror movies having subtext and how that can add to a movie. It gives it a sense of depth that, you know, a standard slasher film might not have. But I think the problem with It Follows is that instead of subtext, it becomes like super text. It's like, STDs, this is a symbol for that.
Yeah.
We're going to have everything in like a really destroyed, rotting environment to symbolize that. Look, she's in a pool. And then in the end of the movie, the pool is broken and leaking. And it's just, it was just so much style over substance. And I felt like the filmmaker made the cardinal sin of, in my eyes, obviously not in critics' eyes because they fucking love this movie, but he exchanged all this kind of like meaning and metaphor and symbolism for actually having things be scary. Opening scene, I think, was good with the girl on the beach. That was really creepy. And like you talked about, Christian, the parking in the garage, mm-hmm. having her in the chair. But everything else was just, it seemed not creepy. Some of it was kind of laughable, like when they're on the beach and the ghost lifts up her hair. And then all of a sudden the guy gets like thrown across the beach. It's like an episode of Scooby-Doo or something.
Why was he playing with her hair? Like, I just kill her.
She had really nice hair. And it's like, wow, this hair's nice. Got distracted. Yeah.
Well, I really found like 3/4 of this movie, I was there. I was in it. I liked it and everything. When it started to be basically the Invisible Man, that's when they kind of lost me. It's like all of a sudden this mystical curse, you could throw a sheet on it over it and shoot it in the head. And it's like,
why would they try doing that when they shot it before and it was fine? And then like convoluted plan to electrocute. Again, that article that JD posted gave all these symbolic meanings for the water and the pools. And I was like, oh, fuck you.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make any narrative sense.
I think what you're talking about is that like, if you're writing a story and you're saying like, okay, I'm going to write this and it's going to have this, it's going to have a subtext, it's going to have a little bit of levels. I'm conscious that I'm going to be writing about this, but I'm not going to beat people over the head with it. And I think that this is a first-time filmmaker, first-time writer, first-time writer, but he's a younger like filmmaker.
Yeah.
And I think that like that type of finesse happens, I think, later on. It's like early in a filmmaker's career, it happens like it's much more, this means this. And this is like somebody like possibly right out of like film school. And so they're used to like looking for deep hidden meanings and really taking apart every single little aspect of the movie. And I think that there are films that works, but I think that when they do it, they don't like just really beat you over the head with it and really try to make everything symbolic. It's just the natural flow of the story, and then it just happens to kind of match up.
Well, the other thing too, Bug, is like you talked about, you know, the influences for Nightmare on Elm Street and Halloween. I saw Halloween a little bit more than Nightmare on Elm Street, although that guy's character is straight up Johnny Depp.
Yeah.
But like when she's in her classroom and she sees the thing outside, that's straight out of Halloween.
Yep.
A lot of the musical soundtrack is definitely very Carpenter influenced. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that I felt like this was a film where the guy was taking a lot of films that he liked and I think maybe thinking they're an homage, but it just felt like he was ripping off a bunch of stuff. It felt like ripped off from Halloween. It felt like ripped off from The Grudge. Even little details like the fact that you don't see the mother's face at all. Even when it seems when she's in, you just see like her talking to somebody in the very corner of the frame.
Yeah.
That felt to me like it was ripped off from the American remake of Let the Right One In.
Yep. Yep.
Which was ripping
off Charlie Brown.
Right. But that made so much more sense because that movie was so centered on just those kids in that sense of isolation. Whereas this one, if they had done every single parent that way, I might have given them a pass, but it was just her mother, and then they show everybody else's parents. So it's like, well, what the fuck? You're just going to do it half-assed?
Yeah.
As I'm talking about it, I'm finding I hate it even more. Like, my rage against this movie for being the artsy, like, art house, pretentious piece of shit that it is.
Wow, that's rough.
Now, I didn't hate it as much as you guys did, obviously, but I totally understand your ire. I totally understand why you wouldn't like why you don't like this. But I will give it to him because I think it's an original concept of something that like kind of is passed as an STD, but also as a curse, and it just kind of feels like that. It feels a little bit like what I was talking about with the shadow people sort of thing, but also like going back to like Glenn wasn't having any of the nightmares until like Nancy was talking to him about the nightmares, and it's like that sort of contagion sort of like problem that happens in the film, and I do think that that was really compelling, and I think it gripped me for most of it. Like, up until the beach scene, I think that I was really, really into this movie, but after that it just kind of lost me. I mean, right when he grabs her hair like that and she starts that stuff happens, I mean, it just really kind of goes out of the way. I thought there was like a part in as I was going along in the movie, I thought the creepy dude that was in love with her was gonna kind of like, when she was like unconscious when she crashed the car, I thought he was gonna sleep with her,
right?
Just to kind of get the curse away from her, and like that was gonna be the twist that it was gonna.
So that would have been like, you talk about Cronenberg's movies, and that would have been more in line with that, like looking at sex and just looking at it unblinkingly and just, you know, and all its good and bad parts and all its creepiness, you know. And I think that's the problem, is that the idea, I mean, you know, there's that trope in horror movies. So, you know, if you have sex, like, you're going to get killed in a horror movie, you have to be, you know, pure. So this is kind of like that push to the nth degree.
Definitely.
But except for that, just the first idea, it's never pushed any farther. Like, the closest it gets is when the Johnny Depp character is killed by the ghost who looks just like his mother, which, you know, obviously, you know, Christian, you didn't even notice that, so that wasn't even done well enough to, you know, set that across, because that's the only thing that was, like, kind of came across as that taboo.
Yeah.
And it's too bad they didn't push the envelope further.
Yeah. What did you guys think of the ending?
Oh, well, first off, I personally was laughing, because I'm like, really? Honestly? He's going to go and sleep with a fucking prostitute? And I'm laughing my ass off, because I'm like, wait, he does this? And I'm like, why would that actually, like, slow it down or potentially even stop it from chasing him? Wouldn't it be faster?
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be like almost like the next, like, what, 2 hours? It'd be back. I mean, walking down the street holding hands. I'm like, wait, does she know that he fucked a prostitute?
Yeah,
like,
I think he does. I mean, she knows, because that's, yeah, it's, I don't know. Yeah, that it gets kind of murky there. And she runs out to the, or she swims out to the boat with those guys partying, and obviously sleeps with them. And that didn't work. I mean, it was right back. It followed her right back. So,
and the prostitute, it's like, that's what I meant about prostitutes. They're like, that would be faster. So how would that slow it down? And I don't know. That whole part, from the big pool scene, that big pool scene, whatever, to that part, was just where I was rolling my eyes a lot. Especially that pool scene. That was fucking stupid. Like,
the pool scene.
Well, that was almost out of the Kevin Bacon, like, Invisible Man movie. Yeah. Didn't they have something like that? Like, where he falls into a pool and they're trying to, like, catch him? And So, I agree with you guys. I think that this guy really culled a lot of pieces from a lot of different movies. I think that the cinematography is great. I think that the soundtrack is really, really well.
Soundtrack is my favorite part.
Really
of the movie,
well done.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
This is sort of like, and maybe Bug, you can help me. I have a question. Is this 80s, like, John Carpenter soundtrack thing? Because I know I've seen other movies. I think The Stranger even had that, where it's sort of like an 80s movie, but it's definitely not an 80s movie.
The Guest? Yeah, The Guest. There's a lot of, I mean, there's a big movement right now.
Yeah. Seems,
there's a lot of people who are just, like, really loving Carpenter. I mean, I think that The Guest is definitely like that. There was a movie called Almost Human that was out that went so far as to, like, borrow the same letter text, like the fonts of The Thing.
Yeah.
And using it as not The Thing, it was for They Live, and they used it for that movie. And it's just like, I can understand that there's a bunch of people who are graduating school now and they're making movies and they want to make them just like
they weren't even exposed to the originals. Like, I feel like they're making they're like they're being influenced by movies that they didn't even see in the theater. Like I could understand if it was like a 40-year-old guy who never was like, I've never made a movie and I'm gonna make a movie, I'm gonna finally achieve my dream, and you know, I'm gonna make it like the movies that I loved growing up. And
yeah,
you know, these
hipsters, they're like wearing old fashioned clothing.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe
no.
That's
I mean,
too much
I don't want to take it away from like this filmmaker, because I think that he did, his intention was in the right place, and I do think that he was successful in a lot of the stuff that we're talking about, like the way it was filmed, the way it was, the way it sounded, the concept. I think that there are a lot of pluses here to this movie.
I think it's competently made. I really do. I think it looked good. There were things that I liked about it. I don't think I hated it as much as Christian and Imp did, but
it was boring.
To a certain extent. The pacing was really slow, and I just wanted it, like, after those first two big scenes, and quite honestly, even that opening scene where she comes running out in the high heels and the neighbor's like, are you okay? And she's standing out like half naked. Like, even as a neighbor, you don't just walk away from that. Like, you're not, you're like, I don't think you're okay. And then the dad comes out and he's like, honey, what do you do? I've got a daughter, she's very young, but if she ever goes running out into the street half naked with her high heel shoes on, I'm gonna be much more concerned than that girl's dad was. So in a way,
they were calling her, they were looking for her.
He kind of came out and he was like, honey, are you okay? And she's like, I'm fine, dad. And then she like runs around in a circle, runs into the house, and it's like the dad is doing laps. Yeah,
and the exercises.
The dad is.
Maybe he just thought there was a storm coming. Ugh, she's running in circles. Must be a storm coming.
That kind of took me out of it. Like when the opening scene is obviously something that's supposed to freak you out and is not really kind of realistic or grounded in any way, I was just like, okay. And you know, there was another scene like that where they finally find the boyfriend who gave her the STD, and they cut to the backyard, and there's no, like, none of the friends, none of them see the guy, and none of them are like, what the hell is wrong with you? Yeah, what are you doing? Like, how could you do this to my friend? You know, there's none of that. They're just in the backyard calmly talking. And to me, that's sort of like an artificial sort of feel that you're trying to introduce to the movie, where it's like everything's really mellow. Nothing's really all that heightened during most of the movie. And
everybody's cool. Everybody's cool.
Yeah, and I just felt like that was phony. Like, I felt like,
again, in that critical piece that JD posted, that was one of the things that they were praising. It was like just the fact that everything was so understated. It was
bullshit.
Like, oh god damn it,
that's bullshit.
My wife and I, who were watching the movie, we got so bored. We started discussing like how, you know, this curse has passed, and we started thinking like, okay, so you have sex, but what if you wear protection? Is that help?
I was wondering, like, that too.
What if you just gave a guy a hand job? Is that sex? What about oral sex? What about if you're with a girl and you smush your vaginas together? Does that count? Help the butt? Does that work?
That,
if you go
that
up,
is
up
the movie
the fanny,
that Christian
so...
Debarry would have wanted to see, by the way.
Yes.
So I have so many questions for the filmmaker about this curse and the specifics.
Yeah. They keep it vague, and I think that one of the things that's really good in all horror is to keep you asking questions and to keep things kind of vague. It's like the ambiguity of the thing, or just like, you don't know, like that first episode of Halloween, you don't know anything about Michael Myers other than he killed his sister. You don't know why. You don't know why he is who he is. You get little snippets from Loomis. You get little snippets from like just what we have seen, but you don't know what's happening there. And I think that smart filmmakers can leave those holes and then just like say, okay, I'm done. You don't need to fill that in, or somebody later can come in and fill that in. But sometimes it feels hollow, but this one, I mean, it is, if you think about it too much, I think it does crumble a lot.
I was disappointed, and maybe it was the hype and everything, but there was something about it where I was like, no, you know, I by the end, I was just like, I'm kind of, you know, especially that last scene where they're walking and they're like, you're supposed to be like, is something following them? Oh my God, that's so creepy. And it really wasn't.
No, not at all. It was so unreal.
Well, that final scene did also remind me of when Jamie Lee Curtis and the rest of the girls are walking down the tree-lined streets in Halloween.
Yeah.
And there's the shape is like following them, and in many ways that's also and I mean the filmmaker has gone right out and said that he's influenced by Halloween, influenced by Nightmare on Elm Street.
That's
things
great.
Are not.
Then make it as exciting as Halloween and Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah.
I think for me, the hype definitely ruined it. And again, going back to talking about like Babadook, and I really like that one despite of all the hype.
I love that.
And I think it's because, again, it comes back to subtext versus supertext. Since like Babadook had a lot of subtext about mental illness and just having a nervous breakdown and the pressures of, you know, being a single mother. But that was all made subservient to the main point of the movie, which was to try to scare the shit out of you.
Whereas
I feel like it follows, the filmmaker got so wrapped up in all of his, you know, symbolism and metaphor and meaning that he forgot to make it scary.
Yep, I
agree.
Well, very cool, guys. I'm sure there are people, every time I post a review for It Follows or anything like that on AICN Horror, I post my review over it, people just go apeshit about it, like fighting back and forth about is it great, is it shit, whatever. I'm somewhere in between there. I think there are aspects of a great movie in there, but I definitely think that I agree with a lot of the criticisms you guys were talking about.
I don't want to say it's shit. I think it's competently made. I think I watched it. I was okay with it, but it's something that I'll probably forget in like a month, and I'll be like, oh yeah, I saw that. Yeah. So... sorry, don't hate me.
That's when it will creep up behind you and kill you.
Yeah, exactly. All right.
But anyway, so this has been Cannibal Horror Cast.
Yay!
And let's say, how about we just say goodbye, Bottle Imp?
Hey, have a good night, everyone.
Does Bottle Imp have a website or anything?
Yes, Bottle Imp, do you have any?
You can check out my artwork at sandradeillustration.com. That's S-A-N-D-R-A-D-E, illustration.com. I have some pieces that I've got to get cracking on for a couple shows coming up for Gallery 1988 in L.A. They're Crazy for Cult show at the end of the year. They're doing a Seinfeld tribute show next month.
Nice.
And a little something called The Force Awakens.
That sounds awesome.
Star Wars.
Yeah, now I actually have to do the artwork.
Nice. Well, nice. And Christian Dabari, do you want to tell us anything that's happening in your world?
You can find my work on Pornhub.com. I have a 33-page story coming up in October for the Krampus graphic novel that will be a tie-in for the film from Legendary Pictures from Michael Dougherty, the director of Trick or Treat.
And did they change the name of that movie? Is it called like an American Christmas Story or a Horror Christmas Story or something like that?
No, I think it's just Krampus.
Oh, is it still Krampus? Okay, cool.
Yeah, they released the... They released the movie poster teaser or whatever not too long ago.
Cool.
That, and I can't talk about anything else that I'm doing right at the moment, but you can find me on Twitter at Chris Dabari and just go from there.
And you are killing people for the government, is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
That's funny. Me too.
And Christian, where can we find you?
You can listen to my podcast on parttimefanboy.com, and you can check out a little comic that I helped with at babybadass.com. And I think listeners of this particular horror cast will like babybadass.com because it's kind of crazy, kind of gory, kind of silly. And anyone who likes crazy, silly stuff should check it out.
Cool. And I am Mark_L_Miller. You can read me on Ain't It Cool News. I recently lost my day job, so I'll be sitting on my couch for a while. Not doing much. No, I'm using this time to write a lot and get a lot of things that have been on the back burner going forward. So,
good.
Yeah. Be so productive. I will be. Yes, and I can't say what I'm working on right now, but it's going to be fun, and horror fans are going to love it, I think. So
cool.
Can't wait for people to share it. So, all right, well, that has been our Cannibal Horror Cast. Thanks to everybody, and thank you for listening, and we will see you next time.
Hard time, sad boy. Part-time. Part-time sad boy.